start. So normally when I teach a class in contemporary halacha, it's very much makoros based. This one actually is unique, that I don't think it's as much makoros based. It's mamish, a very practical halachic piece, and focuses on various issues of preparation for Pesach that Rabbanim need to be clued into. So as opposed to going through a lot of source sheets in halacha, where, you know, if I was teaching or doing in here, which I do on occasion, issues of gynecology and halacha and things of that nature, there'd be a 60-page set of makoros. This is much more what I would call tachlitic in nature from the makoros. There's sheets right there. So the goal of today is really to talk a little bit about the notion of preparation for Pesach and how Rabbanim, Mechanchim, anyone involved in the Avodas HaKodesh, what issues they should be thinking about in the preparations for Pesach. So let me discuss something that's not in the Makoros, but perhaps is the most important piece of this whole thing, and that is the issues of Shalom Bayis that normally happen around Pesach. Unless you live in a perfect family and in a perfect home and never have spent time in the house having Pesach and always have gone away for Pesach, and even then, I think that even in the most perfect of marriages that I'm sure you've all witnessed with your parents, there are at times additional challenges placed upon a family before Pesach. Now imagine if the family structure or the structure between the husband and wife is not as strong as it needs to be. Or imagine if the family, which happens quite often, where the family is having financial challenges, and then Pesach comes. In all of those cases, you have situations in which, where the Rav needs, the Rav, the Mechanech, the Rebbe in the classroom, needs to be sensitive to Shalom Bayis issues that happen Erev Pesach. If there is a family in your community that is already having challenges, you can assume both financial as well as marital challenges, you can assume that some of those challenges will rear their ugly head right before Pesach. And therefore, I just want to sensitize you to the full moon that essentially comes out for Rabbanim, Mechanchim, and anyone playing a role within the Jewish community around Pesach, the Shalom Bayis issues. So if you're familiar with a family that's having financial troubles, you don't have to wait until they come to you for money. There's nothing wrong with calling a family like that in and saying to them, you know, here's $200, $500, $1,000, depending on the size of the family, depending on the community's capacity, and say, here's a loan. You know, if you can pay it back, great. Pay it back in a time frame that you're comfortable with. Don't make the person feel bad about it, but recognize the fact that if there's someone who's come to you throughout the year or someone who's just lost their job, it's right before Pesach, to be proactive will really lower the pressures in the person's home and lower the and really allow that family to have a more spiritual and a more celebratory Pesach experience. The second thing is that there are sometimes books that are put out for Pesach that sometimes don't differentiate between spring cleaning and cleaning for Pesach. So if you've never been in a place since the last time you cleaned for Pesach, there's a pretty good chance that you don't need to clean those areas for Pesach. It's important to recognize that a Rav and a Mechanech has the responsibilities to really teach the community the differences between Bedikas Chametz or cleaning for Chametz to check one's home for Chametz and using this time as a time for spring cleaning. It's wonderful to make sure that your refrigerators get serviced. Not sure it's a requirement before Pesach that your refrigerators get serviced. It's wonderful to, you know, seal your floors. It's not a prerequisite for Pesach. We have to break the sometimes the pressures that we create in ourselves, or that sometimes both men and women create within the family structure or within the community structure regarding Pesach. Therefore, it's important that a Rav have before Pesach, and not a week before Pesach, but a few weeks before Pesach, a conversation on a Sunday morning where the Rav shares, or the Mechanech shares within the classroom, the appropriate expectations for what Pesach, preparations for Pesach are all about, and the difference between Pesach cleaning and spring cleaning, and that places that you've never been at for the year where there's no chametz at do not need to be cleaned in any fashion. And again, being proactive with families that you realize will have stress over this period of time. So that's the first comment I just want to make. The second comment is that if anyone plays the role of a Rav, please God, in the future, you have to realize that sometimes the secretary answers more shilas than you might realize. A good secretary will be a person who protects the Rav and will try to answer the questions for the Rav sometimes. And it's important that you have a conversation with the administrative team that may surround you, and it doesn't mean that they'll happen right away. Sometimes you'll be in a shul, and there are a lot of pluses to this, as somebody who is at a shul that had no administrative support, and then we grew to a team of around 10 or 15. There are pluses in both paradigms. It's important to recognize that you have a conversation with the administrative assistant who's there to protect you, who's there to empower you, who's there to help you, to understand the limits of what the secretary should answer and what the secretary should not answer. So that's an important conversation for you to have, because you might find the secretary answering shilas on, you know, what's permitted to eat, what's not permitted to eat, that person, you know, good chance does not have the same preparations that you do for the job. I remember one time that my secretary, who was a devout Italian Catholic woman, she wore a shetel. I'll never forget that one time, one of the many times that Rabbi Schechter and Revitzin Schechter were in Boca for Shabbos, that Revitzin Schechter had a conversation with my secretary, and since my secretary knew so much of the lingo, the yeshiva lingo, Revitzin Schechter didn't realize that she was, let's just say that she prayed not in a synagogue. And you got to be careful that the secretaries who are there, and the good ones care greatly for their rabbis. In the CJF now, I have an administrative assistant named Marilyn, and she is literally my protection. And they're wonderful, but you got to make sure that when it comes to the halachas of Pesach, that they understand that they're there to protect you or to help you during, it's a very, your time is very precious around the Chagim, but they have to understand the parameters in which they should be operating in and the parameters that they should not be operating in. It's just an important conversation for you to have and to recognize, because you will find yourself in a situation where somebody decides to walk in and sell your secretary their chametz on their own, and, you know, writes out a little document where they sell not only the food but the plates and everything else like that, and may have to tovel everything that they own when Pesach is over. There just is an important recognition of the fact that everybody has their roles, and you need to make sure that those are established. What I'd like to do with you after these words of introduction is to go through some basic issues. We might finish actually before 2:30, if you don't mind. But really deal with the issues. I want to start with Mechiras Chametz, and then I want to deal with some kashrut. So if we look at the last page of this document that I gave you, I want to go through the Mechiras Chametz form. This Mechiras Chametz form is not in Yiddish, even though they are regularly available. They're not in Hebrew, even though they are also regularly available. It's actually in English, because most Goyim that I have transacted with, their Yiddish and Hebrew is slightly limited. And I thought it would be important that they actually understand the transaction itself. So therefore, the English one, I think, works a little bit better. Let's just go through this. This agreement that's made on these dates between the rabbi and the agent. The rabbi referred to as the agent, and let's call the non-Jew, you know, Joe Smith, hereinafter referred to the buyer. Now, the first thing that's important to recognize is, in Mechiras Chametz, is the fact that there are sometimes time zone issues. So I would ask you to move to to move to page 7, and look at the form for the sale of chametz here. Now, the form for the sale of chametz, I used a document that is put out by the Boca Raton Synagogue, and the reason why I feel comfortable using it is because most of this document, although much has been tweaked and adapted and changed by my colleague Rabbi Goldberg, the vast majority of it I wrote, so I'm very comfortable with it. So look at the sale of chametz document here. I, the name of the person who's selling the chametz, authorized Rabbi Goldberg to sell and transfer all chametz of whatever kind of nature which I own or possess or in which I may have interest whatsoever, wheresoever situated in the residence, and then he names the non-Jew, one of the secretaries in the synagogue that he's selling to. The address, the name of the location, the location which the chametz is being located, the kitchen, the food pantry, the approximate value of the chametz, the value of the liquor, and if the person is going away, where they are. And I ask, and I think it is important, that the guy who now owns this chametz has actually access to his or her chametz. So if the family is going away, somebody should have access to the home, and if there's no one that does, I've always asked as the Rav to have a set of keys or a code or anything else like that to be able to get into the home if the non-Jew wants to participate in his or her chametz. Again, I think that we have to make this a real sale, and even though there are many idioms in Yiddish that speak about mechiras chametz being some type of mockery of any type of concrete actions, I think that we need to make sure that it is real. One of the ways that we make sure it's real is, number one is we have values. Number two is we have locations. And number three is that the guy who's buying this actually has access to it. And then, furthermore, you need to make sure that if you're in a different time zone, that that's set up also. So let's say a person's going to California. So I will have a document, I'll have a sale chametz form, I'll asterisk or highlight in the top of the form, this form requires sale at a different time. Why? LA is 3 hours, actually LA is 3 hours earlier. So it doesn't have to be sold earlier, but it has to be bought back later. In other words, and therefore if you look at this form, if you are in a different time zone and you have your chametz with you, consider your chametz sold effective when you wake up on Erev Pesach, and do not consider the chametz bought back or owned by you until the morning after the conclusion of Pesach. Yes?
You don't want to do like something where you do the action now and you only acquire it later, whereas you can have it the night after Pesach?
You can do that, but the concern that I have is twofold. Number one is when we look through the shtar itself, all of the chametz is owned by the non-Jew. All of the chametz is owned by the non-Jew right away. In other words, it's not like the sale just begins after Pesach. It's that the sale starts Erev Pesach, and then what happens is that if you want to continue the relationship with the chametz, you got to pay down the rest of the money. So what you'd have to be careful of in that case is make sure that the document is worded in such a way that at the end of Pesach for the people in LA, that's when the cutoff point for their ability to do the mice is done. I find that to be a little bit complicated. I would like this to be a process in which people realize it's real. There's nobody who's flying in LA that needs their chametz in order to survive. And I think it's just important that there's a recognition of the fact that this is a real sale. I am always extremely concerned. In other words, when you're selling 10 or 20, it's fine. When you have a shul of 600 families or so, and you're selling, you know, 1,000 different contracts of chametz because three, you know, sometimes there's three children in the family or something like that, and you're trying to keep this thing organized, you basically have three sets of chametz documents. You have the chametz documents where you have to sell earlier, a person going to Eretz Yisrael. So, for example, so they're 7 hours ahead of you, so I'll sell it the night prior. So in this case, it would be Sunday night. And then you have, and I'll let them know that their chametz is not available to them, the ones that they might take with them for some strange reason. They can't use that until it is Eis Yontif by us. I just think that you're right. You can do exactly what you said. I'm just not interested in making it that easy for somebody. I'm interested in making sure that the Rav, and you know, is doing the process in the most effective way possible. So I think that there are basically three sets of documents you need to recognize. The documents that you need to sell early in order to make sure that somebody is not, even if the chametz is located in the States and they're in Israel, that their chametz is not being owned by them when it's already Pesach for them. The chametz that you're buying back late, and that is, like, for example, chametz from somebody like in Los Angeles where Pesach is over 3 hours later than it's over here, or X amount of hours later than it's over here. And the standard chametz situation where you're in a similar time zone. And so therefore, what I do is, I always keep these time zones. This, we add this comment in there to remind people. It can either be filled out, and I think it's best to be filled out in person, or if not, it can be done online. I've also done something which, again, is everybody has to make their own decisions, and I'm not suggesting that mine is correct and someone else's is not. I've always used the Mechiras Chametz time as not a way of getting more money for myself, but rather as a way in which people can give money for scholarships. Way before there was the official tuition crisis, when you're a rub of a shul, as I had the privilege of being, and you were also the person who started the schools, you understood the responsibilities to make sure they were fiscally sound. So I created a fund, and people would actually give more money because they realized it wasn't for the rabbi. And then when I negotiate the salary for my contract, you know, it was clear that I wasn't making some extra money on the side. You guys are very blessed, and that is that you have a person like Rabbi Schwartzberg, please God, when you become Rabbanim, Mechanchem, who can help negotiate your salaries. And, you know, this is a CJF side point for a second. You should take advantage of that, because I can promise you this, he'll do a better job negotiating your salaries than you'll ever do for yourself. So he'll protect you, and it won't create a conflict in any ways for you. But getting back to our task for this afternoon, I always set aside the money for that for Yeshiva Day School scholarships, and it became a way in which I was able to partner with the schools of putting together, you know, 50, 60, sometimes more thousands of dollars, because people gave more than the $5. Because they realized it was for Yeshiva scholarships, they gave some money in order to enable children to go to day school, and I felt that was a wonderful synergy with Mechiras Chametz. So let's go back to the document at the end of the handout. There are two sales that essentially happen here: the sale of the locations and the sale of the Chametz itself. So let's go through this. Now, since it is unclear exactly which kinyanim work in our interactions with non-Jews, we go through multiple kinyanim and set them up in ways in which one is not tabui on the other, and that's an important recognition for one to do. So let's just read through this, and I read through this simply just to give you that clarity. Where certain persons whose names are set forth upon certain inventory sheets delivered herewith to the buyer, herein referred to as sellers, are desirous of selling all chametz owned by them and in which they have any interest whatsoever, and whereas each of the said sellers have designated, appointed, and empowered Phil and the rabbi as their legally designated agent to sell, transfer, and dispose all such chametz in such manner and upon such terms as said agent in his sole discretion shall deem appropriate, and whereas the buyer here on above identified is desirous of purchasing all the said chametz of the sellers in accordance with the terms of the agreement. Now therefore it is agreed by the buy and between the agent as the agent for the sellers and each of them and the buyer that the agent hereby sells, etc., 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 hereby purchases all the chametz belonging to each and every one of the persons herein referred to as sellers, whose names are set forth upon the individual inventory sheets of each seller. So now, by the way, the inventory sheets are these forms. I make a set of these forms for the Jew, for myself, and I have a set of the forms for the non-Jew. The term chametz is intended to include all leavened products, etc., 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 included but not limited to all items specifically enumerated upon the individual inventory sheets of each seller. Someone calls me up and says, oh, Rabbi, I made a horrible mistake. I forgot to include all the wine, all the liquors in my liquor cabinet. I feel horrible. I didn't put them on my sheet. Does that work? Yes, it does work, because I said even the chametz that's not enumerated here works. And in order to effect the sale, the buyer agrees to pay the agent the sum of the estimated fair market value of all of the chametz as determined by three recognized experts according to the accepted market value prevailing today in, let's say, New York City, and which shall be paid by the buyer as follows. $1 per person right now, the rest on or before, and what time do you put there? Ice Yontif. You put the time after Yontif. So in other words, what happens is you give them some money now. So let's say I have 1,000 people that I'm selling chametz for. So in this case, I give them $1 per person. I give them $1,000 right now. The guy has to give me $1,000 right now. Does the guy have to give me dollar bills? Does he actually have to give me cash, currency, coins? Rabbi Willig, who has a wonderful video on Mechiras Chametz. Have any of you seen his video on Mechiras Chametz? I'll see if I can get it and have Rabbi Schwartz send out an email to you and just link it. I don't think it's on Wadi Torah, but I think we'll see if we can get it on there. He actually is machbid also to use coins. And then what happens is that there's other ways of sale. So if you look at the next paragraph, in addition, the buyer gives as an item of personal property to the agent. They do chalipin and they shake hands in accordance with the common custom of sales. These additional methods of acquisitions are employed because of the question about the effectiveness of each method. It is emphasized that each sale and method of sale is independent and therefore unaffected by any invalid sale or method of sale performed in this agreement, because there are different shitas that say different forms of kinyan and work. Chalipin is the quintessential kinyan. Other kinyan may work, may not work. So the bottom line is do all them all, but not that they are one kinyan, but rather they're separate kinyanim, and the ones that work, work. The ones that don't work, okay. And then in addition to that, there's a second sale that happens. And that is, the second sale that happens is of leases the cabinets, the storage rooms, the garages, the basements, or any other place in which there's any type of chametz whatsoever, and that's also in the location. Then there's another set of money given, a set of $1 for each of the enumerated sellers, and then there's all those kinyanim done for a second thing. So there's two sets of kinyanim done. One for locations, one for the actual chametz. And then what happens, at least the way I do it, you don't have to do it this way. You can call up the guy, Matzei Pesach, and you can ask the guy, do you want to continue the sale? If the guy does want to continue the sale, you're good, and you're done. I actually go to the guy. I think it's important, again, to concretize this in a serious way. Go to the guy, have a conversation, ask them if they want to continue it. Assuming that they don't want to continue it, money is returned to them, we part as friends. And normally, I'll give them a tip for the time that they paid. Not normally, I'll give them a tip for the time that they paid and for their time, and we greatly appreciate it for their engagement in this process. So the whole thing takes, just a few minutes after Pesach. And the pizza shops, if they're selling chametz with you or any other places that might open Matzei Pesach, should understand, based on the Rav, when they can start using their chametz. In other words, they can open their pizza shops, warm their ovens, But you should have a conversation with them. Most of the stores don't really open till after, till the next morning, so it's irrelevant. But there are those exceptions to the rules. I just give you one. The pizza shops, that you just have a conversation with them. You know, I used to joke with the pizza shop in Boca. I used to say to them, your chametz is either ready a half an hour after Pesach or an hour, depending if my family gets the first pie. You know, but the bottom line is that you just make sure that they understand that until you buy it back, which again is just a few minutes, and it's not going to make any difference whatsoever, that they simply are aware that they shouldn't start until you inform them. There are things that happen in these situations. For example, and I'm not saying that you have to do this, I'm just giving you my best practices, or what I think my best practices are. And that is, I used to actually have the guy to go to one or two of the places on Chol HaMoed and visit their chametz. And some of them actually who liked single malt actually tasted their chametz. Not so much that they, you know, we had to pay back something at the end. But the bottom line is that people should realize, you go to one or two people in the community to visit their chametz, everybody in the community knows that happened. And it just makes it more real. Then there are the stranger situations where somebody, let's say, owns a pharmacy and needs to keep the pharmacy open on Pesach. Now, they don't have to keep the Hershey chocolate bars out there and other things of that nature, but there might be certain types of materials that are chametz mamish for medicines and stuff like that that are necessary. And so what we worked out, and this was in consultation with Rav Schechter when I had this issue, it's not a complicated thing. We worked out what the rent of the store was, figured out what the profit was minus the expenses, and let's say it was over the period of Pesach, let's say there was $500 of profit after people were paid, after this, after that, the guy actually got that profit. Now the guy actually was sensitive to this whole process and actually, thank God, donated the $500 to the Yeshiva Scholarship Fund. But the bottom line is, it's the guy's profit. And if you're serious about it, you need to be serious about it. You can't just do a wink, wink. So I'm just trying to give you various permutations just so that you should be sensitive to these issues. And I actually find this to be one of the most daunting parts of Erev Pesach, to make sure you do this process right. After 120 years, you don't want no entry to Olam Haba because 100 people or more, were over the issue of Kareis because of your issues. And therefore, this should be taken with some significant degree of seriousness. Yes?
In terms of extended market value, you just trust whatever people put down on their respective forms?
Right, and then if the guy wanted to continue, then you wouldn't have to use the three people. But I start off trusting what they are. Well, most Jews know the value of their chametz. Most of them inflate the value of their chametz. And then, as it says, if the guy ever decided that he or she wanted to spend millions of dollars on the community's chametz, or hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of dollars on the community's chametz, so then you have to bring in three experts to evaluate it in a forensic way. But I started off like that.
And as the Rav, you have the one in his sole discretion, you have the power to set whatever price you want,
right,
and sell it under any condition you want.
Right. Yes. Haven't you heard this before? Yeah, go on.
If that happens, that the Rav says, yes, I would like to continue with the sale.
Send out an email blast to everybody and say, well, then they're only over in Isser Gazela afterwards, not in Isser Kareis afterwards. But, which is different. Rav Moshe has a famous tshuva about that, where there were stores owned by Jews that didn't want to close on Pesach, and they had chametz in them, and he encouraged the Rabbanim to be able to do Mechiras chametz with those store owners because the Isser of Gazela was less than the Isser of having Hanach and chametz on Pesach. In the history of the rabbinical world that I am familiar with, which is, I would suggest, at least in the American Jewish community, I have significant familiarity. It's not only a milsa de lo shchicha, it's a milsa that's never happened. So I'm not sure I'm concerned about that. And, first of all, you have to pick a guy who actually can afford to do it. Anyone who has business sense isn't buying every Jew's half-eaten chametz. Secondly, you have to trust. I trust the guy that would interact. It's not a guy that I just picked off the street for 15 minutes who I would ask to turn on my lights if something happened or something like that. You know what I mean? This is a person you have a relationship. Rabbanim have relationships with non-Jews all the time. You know, there are secretaries of states that when they were kids bought chametz for Rabbanim. You know, you have relationships, and that's the way you do it. Okay? So that's just the beginning. That's just to give you a nice overview. This is a really good document for you to have, for you to keep in your library. I actually still remember in my contemporary halacha when Rabbi Neuberger gave some wonderful stuff, and I actually kept some of those documents. I hope that this makes it into that category. And if you want it sent to you by email, just send me an email, and I'll send it to you. But it's a good document to have. Let's now move from Mechiras Chametz to the review sheets and conversations about the Pesach in general. And that, we start again, let's go to the beginning of the handout and let's turn to page 2. And that's just a simple schedule. Now, if I was doing programming aspects, which is appropriate not here, I would talk about the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha and the seriousness of the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha. I talk about ways in which you should get people to the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, dessert receptions, and, you know, or like, which is a mini Sudah Shlishit, and putting mincha, you know, after the dessert reception, which makes sure that more people are at mincha than if you reverse the order, you know, making sure that we reach out to the teens in a spiritual, nurturing way, making sure there's childcare, so the rabbis, Shabbos HaGadol Drasha is not just for one spouse, but both spouses can participate. Those are important things that a Rav should worry about, because there's different forms of dealing with the chametz. There's a chametz shebalev, chametz shebemalach, and removing that chametz, as Rav Kook and others discuss. And then there's the other chametz, and it's important that the Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, you know, deal with those types of issues. I want to, however, move towards some of the issues regarding preparing one's kitchen and some other things. So if we can turn to page 3 of our handout, you'll see that there's just a little summary, which you don't need me for, the prohibitions of chametz, the whole reminding people that food stores that are owned by Jews who didn't sell the chametz can't be patronized after Pesach. What is chametz? What is kitnius? And then we start dealing with medicines issues, which I'm going to get back to a little bit. Cosmetics and toiletries, which we've, thank God, got to a point where people are recognized that things that are not, that are nifsam and achilas kelev, do not need to be kosher for Pesach. So body soaps, creams, eyeshadows, eyeliners, face powders. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, Rabbi Soloveitchik would tell, toothpaste does not need to be kosher for Pesach. I remember once in Shir, I've said this story once before, that Rabbi Soloveitchik said that toothpaste is not Rabbi Achilles Kalev. There was a guy who took a tube of Crest, went to Laurel Hill Terrace, and came back the next day and said, Rebbe, I just want you to know that the dog ate an entire tube of Crest. At which point Rabbi Soloveitchik said, who are you going to believe, me or the dog, of what's Rabbi Achilles Kalev? So that's the, you know, those issues regarding... And if we turn to the next page, I think now we get into what I would call the heavy lifting of Pesach, and that is making sure that that we deal with certain sensitive issues. And I want to speak about, first of all, kashery. Now, I think that shuls, especially in neighborhoods where the shul plays the central role as the center address of the community, it's nice if a shul and the rav of the shul prepares the way to kosher kalim for Pesach. In other words, you buy a very large pot that is going to be, you know, 60 times, you know, greater than anything anyone's going to put in the pot. You boil up the pot before, you boil up the water beforehand, and a Sunday, a week or so before Pesach, like not the Sunday coming up, but the Sunday prior, you open up for the mornings. And either you hire a mashgiach or you do it yourself, or you get some balabatim to do it with you, and you kosher things for people. That way you make sure that the koshering is done correctly. And you have to be careful what you kosher and what you don't kosher. We're gonna discuss it a little bit more. And you have to be careful how you do it. There's one rav that you know, sometimes that the proximity of Shabbos and Pesach can be such we don't have Eino Ben Yomo. And so I know one Rav who put bleach into the water so that he was pogging it and stuff like that, but it was very nice. But every Becher came out totally bleached. And so while it was Eino Ben Yomo and they were kosher, but let's just say they never made it to the Pesach Seder table either. Neither did the rabbi, neither did the rabbi's contract. But the bottom line is that the bottom line is that you just have to do it with some what I would call seichel hayasher. But for you to create an opportunity for there to be koshering in the shul, or I used to not do it in the shul, but I used to actually do it on the Federation campus, which had a much larger kitchen, or the JCC, or the school, a place that has a large. It's not a hard thing. It's about just koshering a burner and making sure you have a big pot. It's really not complicated. Make sure you don't burn yourself. There are many different things that you need to talk about koshering. And let me just start with some of the no-nos, and then we'll move to them. And that is, let's remind ourselves that sometimes Rabbanim will be connected to Avada Kashrus. I remember in Florida, when we started the Avada Kashrus, it was quite small, but as it grew, the ORB, Rabbi Davis and myself were the heads of the Avada Kashrus, and all of a sudden, all of these hotels started coming for Hashgacha. I remember one cook saying that he heard there are 600,000 Jews who crossed the Red Sea, and he believes that all 600,000 Jews actually eat in his hotel. But the bottom line is that sometimes mashgichim that you might supervise, or actually you might play that role, become trigger happy with blow torches, and they burn out thermostats like there's no tomorrow. It's important to recognize the fact that if you are going to be responsible for a group of people, first of all, it's going to happen that thermostats are going to blow. They're very sensitive, and when you're blowtorching, which is not something that happens in a kitchen in a home, and I'm talking about industry kitchens, then sometimes that stuff is going to happen, and a good Rav will actually have a list of people who could actually fix the ovens. So that if you're responsible for Avada Kashrus, you'll deal with those issues. In the local kitchens, in the kitchens we have in our homes, there are some standard kitchen stuff. I wanted to share with you a few different. I wanted to share with you three different handouts because I believe that they are the best, in addition to the OUs. And that is a local shul's handout. You all should be putting together something for your shuls. Feel free to copy this. I'll give you this in Word. You're more than welcome to copy it. Just change the name of the rabbi. But feel free to copy it. And I remind people about that because there's one person who copied it and I forgot to change the name of the rabbi. So the range tops, for example. A gas range top. Let's just go through this because I think it's just important. Clean the whole top, the spiders, the cups, the slide-out trays, wait 24 hours. You're just making sure that it's an Eino Ben Yomo thing. You're paying Pugum. Then, invert the spiders or leave them on the highest setting. Now, it says here for 1 hour. I don't think it needs to really be on for 1 hour. If you leave something on the highest setting for 20, 25 minutes, it's not going to get hotter than that. So I'm not sure you need an hour. And after this is done, you can cover the range with aluminum foil, or you can kosher the range. For example, some range tops have in it, what they have is they have burners, and around it are grates. So, for example, my range top at home has grates. What do? I take those grates, and I put them in the self-clean cycle of the oven. So they go through a three-hour self-clean cycle, and I kosher the oven and the grates at the same time. I've created a new kli. It's leaven gummer for 3 hours in a self clean cycle. I take those grates out with not with my bare hands, but with mitts, and I put them back on. I turn on the fires for 20-25 minutes, which is at its highest flames, and then I'm done, and I've koshered out the entire top. Now, there are times in which you cannot do that. Let's say the pieces are not ones that can be kosher in that way, or you have a stovetop that has other other parts that cannot be koshered. If you can use an aluminum foil to cover it, that's great. The best thing is an industrial type aluminum foil, the aluminum foil that you can get at a not the cheap aluminum foil, but a better strength aluminum foil. Also, for example, let's look at electric. Follow the above procedure, except that the electric burners should be set on the highest setting. Wait until they are glowing red and leave them on for additional 15 minutes. Cover the entire range with aluminum foil. Care should be taken to only kosher one burner at a time. That's only to make sure that you don't destroy the range. For many range tops, covering with aluminum foil is not possible, and they'll discuss that in the workshop. So if you have, for example, a range top that you cannot kosher, what I would personally do, if you have a range top, you can kosher the burners, can't kosher the other tops, what I would do is I'd boil up hot water, and I would wait 24 hours, create an inabinyomo, use a caustic agent to clean it. I would boil up boiling hot water, I'd actually pour it on the range top. It does not create a full koshering process. But then I would do is I would get trivets. And I would have trivets so that if somebody is taking something and a pot and you've koshered the area around the pot and you want to put it in the center for some reason of the stovetop, you don't put it on the stovetop mamish, even though it's ein binyomo and you koshered it on one way and it's probably still 100% okay. But if you put it on a trivet, you've obviated any issues whatsoever. And that's what I would inform people to do. When it comes to ovens, most ovens are self-cleaning ovens. You use a full cycle and you're pretty good. The microwave is explained here also. Obviously, the glass tray can't be koshered. Now, keep in mind, with self-cleaning ovens, around the frame of the oven itself, there's a lot of be'en there. So it's important that you clean out that be'en, because even sometimes that be'en doesn't get totally destroyed. What I simply do is, or what my wife and I have decided is done in our home, because she's actually doing more of the heavy lifting than I am, is there's actually some type of easy-off for self-cleaning ovens. We spray the easy-off around the frame. You clean it a little bit, and the bottom line is that by doing that, you've been nifsal the be'en in a whole bunch of different ways. It's ein binyomo. You've been nifsal the be'en, and then you run it through a self-cleaning cycle, and that's it. Refrigerators should be cleaned. Now, sometimes people have this thing, and you'll see. I'll show you the CRC, which I think has one of the best sites for Pesach, and I just want you to keep that in mind because it actually has their information pretty timely. In other words, not 2 weeks before Pesach, but pretty timely. And the Star K also has it in a pretty timely fashion. If you look, one says you have to put a lining on the shelves. One says you don't have to put a lining on the shelves. Frankly, I don't understand. The whole thing's totally cold. You clean it up. You clean it. I don't understand why you need a lining whatsoever. But let me tell you my concern. The people who put a lining on it, what they often do is they just line the shelves and they don't perforate the lining. If you don't perforate the lining, then what you'll do is you'll stop the flow of air in your refrigerator. A refrigerator works with a flow of air. And what will essentially happen is you will destroy the food in your refrigerator. The food will spoil because you are not allowing the refrigerator to function. So if somebody decides that they want to advocate, and you should ask your local Rosh Yeshiva what they feel, the Rosh Yeshivas from YU that I've had conversations with on this, none of them understand why you need to cover the refrigerator shelves once they're cleaned. But let's say you decide that for some reason you want to do it. Just make sure that you inform people that the shelving that you use, the linings that you use, need to be perforated, or else you will compromise the hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars of foodstuff that are in the refrigerators, because as the shelves are slotted, so should the coverings be slotted. Countertops, essentially, if there are no abrasions on the countertops, you know, no big cuts in the countertops, boiling hot water poured over the countertops should work to be able to kosher the countertops, again, making sure that they are eino binyomo. Now, what I want to do is, before I get to the next issues, I want to just give you a tour of some of this information because I want to just speak about it. So first of all, you know, we're pretty mafid that dishes and utensils other than metal that we don't kosher. Now, but keep in mind, keep in mind that it's important. Like I've had people who have come to me to kosher fancy earthenware, fancy actually glazed china that I knew when they became Shomer Shabbos, they had such financial difficulties that I used the tshuvas of the Chazon Ish of how you kosher it, even though you know, putting in the three different pots of hot water, even though I do not consider that to be a norm, I would never publish that anywhere. But a Rav needs to recognize that he's not answering, he's answering Shilas as the community leader for the community, and then the Rav needs to be sensitive to the needs of the individual families. And therefore, in your arsenal, halachic arsenal, you have to create community policies, and in your halachic arsenal, you have to be sensitive to the needs of particular individuals. Glass utensils, again, only if we live in a world where, you know, you can go to Amazing Savings and get glass utensils at a pretty cheap rate. But if for some reason you feel that the family needs to kosher them, they've only been used by cold, you know, you can put them in water for three consecutive days, changing the water every 24 hours. Metal utensils that can be koshered, you have to make sure that if there's any places on the metal utensils where there are joints, that the joints have been unscrewed and it's been cleaned. It's explained on page 5 here. But it's important to recognize, that's one of the reasons why I'm advocating for you to create, at least early on in your rabbinate, a community koshering, so that you train people, not just through a conversation, which sometimes people will fall asleep during, or something like that, but rather you create a situation in which you show them, you instruct them, in a hands-on way, how koshering is done effectively. And by the way, when you sell chametz, when you buy the person's chametz, so sometimes there's a line outside the door because people wait for the last minute, and sometimes there are these opportunities to have these pastoral mini moments. So when someone sells you the chametz, and there's not somebody waiting outside, and you've dedicated this time to purchase people's chametz and to be their agents, there's nothing wrong with asking them to sit down, how you doing, how things are going, how's your child, how's this, how's that. There are these windows of opportunity that sometimes sell it. I was pretty jealous, and I didn't really let the assistant rabbi sell chametz as many hours as I did, not because I enjoyed filling out the forms with the people, but I really loved it to be an opportunity to reacquaint and re-engage with certain people that by definition you might not see because they're not coming to you with too many shilas. They're not coming to you with too many questions. They're not engaging you on a regular basis. They may not be the people coming to Minyan every single day. They might be coming to Minyan only on Shabbos, or for that matter, not even always on Shabbos. Or if they come on Shabbos, they participate in the minyan in the hallway and not the minyan, in the shul. So this is an opportunity for you to engage in those relationships. And don't recognize that there are those sacred moments that allow you to achieve some real goodness that is, you know, between the lines of the laws here that are wonderful. So there are these laws about B'dikas Chametz, B'ir Chametz. I think we're pretty familiar with them. I wanted to just move you on to the CRC piece, which is found on page 9. I find this piece on page 10 to be wonderful and important. It's a recent addition. I need to call Rav Gedalia and suggest to him that he adds Rabbi Brand, who is the Rosh Kollel of the YU Kollel in Toronto, to this list. But the bottom line is encouraging people to recognize the fact that number one is all pill medications that are easily swallowed, that's not a chametz issue. And I have found many, many times that people who are so interested in being makbid on Pesach sometimes even really make silly mistakes and, for a lack of a better term, although they mean this for all the right reasons, really are chassid shotas, in which they basically decide that a certain medicine might be chametz stick or something else like that, or it's a capsule and might not be Pesach stick or something like that, and really they compromise their health. You as a rabbanim have the responsibility of being machbid and to communicate effectively these halachas. There's a famous story that Rabbi Soloveitchik brings down in Ish Halacha, where He speaks about Rav Chaim from Volozhin, and that there was some type of illness in, or I don't know if it was Rav Chaim or his own father, there was some type of illness in town, and on Yom Kippur he made Kiddush on Kol Nidre night. His Balabatim came over to him and said, "How can you be so makel with Yom Kippur?" And he said, "I'm not so makel with Yom Kippur, I'm just makbid on issues of Pekuach Nefesh." This is not about being makel on Pesach, it's being makbid to make sure that people don't compromise their health. People compromise their health in significant ways on Pesach. And we have to make sure that we communicate those messages. And if people have questions about their medicines, the first answer is you should use them. If you have questions, feel free to come to me as the Rav, and you'll do the research. And that research is essentially available on two important websites. One is the CRC website and the Star K website. There's a Rabbi Bess from Los Angeles who does a lot of research, and basically now all that research is found on the Star K website. For me, as a practicing Rav, those were the two websites that I looked at, with the OU website, although the OU is more involved with products than it is with, I would call, these meta issues. And I would make sure that I printed this material out and had my secretary check for updates, because they're very well researched and they're very well organized. So if you turn to page 10, if you look at page 11, page 12, page 13, it goes through koshering. And by the way, if you call these websites up, they will not mind that if you link your information or you copy some of their pages and put it on your website. As long as you give them credit, they'll be very happy about it. Page 14 summarizes certain countertops. Page 15 and 16, we'll speak about a little bit about Tfilas Kalim and Hechsher Kalim, koshering in general, all different types of things, how you can kosher them, how it's supposed to be done, etc., etc., etc. And I wanted to give you this, not because it's not available on the web, because number one is these are really good charts for you as a practicing Rav to have. And most important is I want to remind you that, please God, when you are a practicing Rav, when you're Mechanech in the school and you want to educate, use these websites, the CRC websites and the Star K websites in particular, to guide yourself and to be able, it's very user-friendly for the members of your community. So look at the CRC. Oh, I wasn't going to give you their shopping list for Chicago, because it's not relevant to everybody in this room or anyone. I'm not sure if it's relevant to anyone in this room, but this, if you look at pages 19 and 20, the pages I gave to you here, those are what I would call general kashrus, the general type of stuff, which is very relevant wherever you are. What coffee, what fit, you have to worry about for fresh, you have to worry about for fruit, and things of that nature. By the way, as we're mentioning some of this stuff, we know that, for example, frozen vegetables, although frozen vegetables, what could be chametz sick about frozen vegetables, and that is we live in a world of globalization, and the material which makes frozen vegetables also makes various forms of pasta. So frozen vegetables do require hashgacha. But for example, milk, which we try to say to buy milk with hashgacha, if you buy milk without hashgacha before Pesach, the only challenge with milk is sometimes the vitamins that are added to milk might be kidneys or things of that nature, and we're mevatel it if you buy it before Pesach, not if you buy it on Pesach. And so therefore, it's best to, if you can't buy milk with supervision, you can buy it before Pesach, and you can freeze the milk, or you can, I mean, there's no place where you can, or you buy milk on Pesach with supervision. Pages 23, 24, 25, 26, they all deal with issues of, you know, medicines, and I want to move you to page 27. Now, keep in mind, I'm not sure how many of you have pets or don't have pets. Personally, I'm not, you know, we don't have any pets in our home. But the bottom line is that it's, you know, it might not be something chashuv to you, but I'm telling you, if you have somebody in your community that has pets, showing them the sensitivity that you've dealt with this, which, by the way, simply just means pointing them to the CRC website, which is not a tircha gedola, or taking the CRC website stuff and cutting and pasting it in a handout that you put together, obviously recognizing that it came from there, is a way of showing your community and showing those who have a certain sensitivity. So I'm pointing this out to you, not because we need to go through it, I'm pointing it out to you because you need to make sure that that's part of your consciousness when you prepare your community for Pesach. And towards that end, we now move on page 29 to another, the Star Kays, which again is wonderful. And again, they have their own list on page 30 of our handout, where it says page 10. And you'll notice, for example, refrigerator on page 30, thoroughly clean. Lining shelves is not necessary. If you look at the CRC thing, you'll see thoroughly clean, but must line the shelves. Again, I don't know why one is, I don't see why it's necessary. Maybe one of these days I'll call the CRC and ask them why they thought it was. Page 32 gives you some information more about the medicines, but I really wanted to point out to you, more importantly than that, is another piece that's important, and that's page 37, or where it says in the for the Star K, page 59. I want to point out to you something that is an extremely important problem. Many Rabbanim will deal with the fact that after Pace or after the Siddurim, they will have congregants that will have to be rushed to the hospital. And that's because they haven't taken care of themselves properly. Now, you know, if it's a small shul, you might not have the problem, but in a large shul, and in any hotel that I've ever been at, there's always been that challenge that there's an ambulance that comes on the first 2 days of Pesach, at least once. And that's a lot of times because diabetics are not trained how to deal with diabetes on Pesach. Carbs is, you know, the middle word of Pesach. Carbs are deadly for a diabetic. You know, Pesach night, you know, between the matzah and a heavy wine with a lot of sugar or grape juice, which has, I don't know, I checked before this class last night, like 32 or 42 grams of sugar per 8 ounces and stuff like that. You know, it is a quick ride to the hospital if you don't watch yourself properly. Rabbanim need to train their congregants of how to do this effectively. And again, it's not a lot of work on your part because people have done the work for you in the Star K. So I'm just going to point out some of the issues. For example, the fact that whole wheat matzahs have less carbs than regular matzahs. The fact that that hand matzahs have less carbs than machine matzah. There are shiurim. You don't have to be machben on the shiurim when it can put you in a suffix sakana. And it's important to recognize this type of thing. And also important to recognize because some diabetics are actually insulin dependent and they'll give themselves more insulin based on the Seder meal, which can take care of those issues. Also important to recognize that wine with the least amount of alcohol is better. So in preparation for this class, I went to for a few minutes yesterday to one of the local wine places in Queen Anne Road, and you could actually find wine with just 5% alcohol or 4.5% alcohol. I don't think halakhically less than I think the Star K writes somewhere here that you have to be careful not to have less than 4% alcohol, but you can find wine with 4.5%, like the standard Moscato, which some people view as just soda, is like 5.5% alcohol. You don't have to buy the dry wines that have 10% alcohol, 11% alcohol, 12% alcohol that actually make it harder. And sometimes those wines, which have a stronger sugar content to it, the smaller the percentage of alcohol, the less amount of sugar is in that wine. So this is just important information that a Rav needs to know to make sure that Ushmartam is nafshal seichem. And we're all going to have diabetics in our congregations, and most of us will never know who they exactly are because most of them will never share that information with us. But simply making informed comments, even if the comment is just, I've sent out material to each and every one of you, and I just want to point out to you that there is some information about that for diabetics, I would ask you that you look at that information if it's relevant. You have, you will definitely make a person's life easier over Yontif, and there's a pretty good chance you actually might save a person from a visit to a hospital or a visit at least to a doctor over Chol HaMoed. So I am just sensitizing you to these, some of these issues, and all of that is really why I put together this handout. And again, the Star K itself, on pages, the last pages of our handout 46 and 47, also goes through the various food stuff for animals. We are not yet at the messianic point where the various Vade Hakashras have agreed to come out with one form. That would be too easy for us, and instead of everybody making Shabbos for themselves. But the bottom line is, these are the important issues for you to be familiar with, whether it's the issues of Mechiras Chametz, whether it's the issues of how you kosher the kitchen, whether it's creating ways in which you can kosher in the shuls, whether it's recognizing how you kosher the more cutting-edge types of things, like, for example, glass tops. Glass tops are very hard to kosher. One way to kosher a glass, to deal with a glass top is if you use a, if you want to do Lieben Gomor and use a blowtorch, it's very easy. You won't have to worry about it because you'll break the glass top and you'll need a new oven, you'll need a new stovetop. So you have to be very careful how you kosher a glass top. Most people kosher glass top in one of two ways. They just pour boiling hot water over it, which is not a real koshering, and they put trivets on the glass top. You can't put aluminum foil on it, it'll just melt in. Or one way to kosher it, another way I thought to kosher it is, after you turn it out, is to create some type of Lieben Kal type of koshering process. I'm not going to share that with you because I think it's a little too hard for most people to do. Or I will share it, I'll just mention it, and that is, what I used to do is used to take it, create an aluminum tent over the entire glass stovetop, an aluminum tent. I would turn on all the burners. I'd put rocks in there so the tent could not fall onto the stovetop. And I would wait till it really gets really hot, and I would take a piece of New York Times, roll it up into like a little, you know, cone, and I'd run it back and forth in the middle, and I would watch that basically get singed and get on fire. Not over the burner, because that doesn't help you, but in the middle there, and I thought that that created a heat source that was like it speaks about with Kash, of simply, you know, burning, singeing the kosh. But I think that a better way of doing it is simply to think about the way I mentioned with trivets, which is not as complicated as what I just said to you, and allows you to achieve the same goals. So I know it's before 2:30. I'm sorry to disappoint you that we didn't go till 2:30, but if anyone, we'll take some questions, and then we'll conclude. Any questions? Comments, criticisms, concerns. Yes?
I think that the wines with the higher alcohol really have the lead moisture.
That's not.
The sugar turns into alcohol, so the wine with 5% alcohol have much more sugar in general. They have much more sugar than the wine with 12, 13, 14.
That's not what the people told me last night who run the stores.
For diabetics, it's much better to take a dry wine and dilute with water than to take a sweet wine.
What? Is that what he says there?
It's 40.
Okay, then I stand corrected. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate you. Let's go back to that person I went to last night. Thank you. Okay. Any other questions or comments or corrections? Okay. So, have a chakash of a sameach. Thank you very much for that correction. And we'll stop here.